This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Later this hour, we'll talk with Miriam Wallace. She's a professor of English at New College in Sarasota and the ringleader of Frankenfest 2018. It's a series of talks, concerts, and film screenings celebrating Mary Shelley's short novel, Frankenstein, or The Modern Prometheus. But first, living in a world of fake news. That's the title of my first guest's upcoming lecture at Florida Southwestern State College in Fort Myers on Monday, February 19th, as part of the college's Critical Thinking Lecture Series. Ron Feimster is a professor of journalism who's been tracking the current trends in so-called fake news, as well as its origins throughout the history of disseminating news and information all the way back to the dawn of the printing press. As a journalist, Feimster's byline has appeared in more than 30 publications over 30 years, from specialized education and housing quarterlies in the New York Times. He has published in German as well as English and has covered topics ranging from public housing to country music to the pharmaceutical industry to Indian reservations. Before joining FSW, he taught journalism in New York City, Wyoming, Kansas, and India. Professor Feimster, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. We appreciate you coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. We're talking about fake news, past, present, and future on today's show. If you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. So tell me first, how did this lecture topic come about?
Well, it actually started with a conversation with the director of the library at FSW, who said we should have a talk about journalism. And this was during the run-up to the presidential election, and we decided to have a talk about fake news in January, and it turned out to be a much hotter topic than we had expected it to be.
A lot of interest.
Before the election. A lot of interest, and it had kind of exploded into the news at that time. I think it was fake news was something that journalists were paying attention to, and all of a sudden, about the time that President Trump started tweeting about fake news, everyone was paying attention to fake news.
So this is something you've been talking and thinking about it for at least a year and a half.
Yeah, probably a little longer than that, but thinking about it anyway.
Well, thinking about it, yeah, for sure. Well, how do you define fake news broadly?
Broadly, I would say fake news is any kind of publication where the publisher knows that the content is false and they're publishing it anyway with some ulterior motive besides informing the public, either to make money or to pursue some kind of ideological end.
Does that include twisting news, taking facts and showing only certain sides of it?
Well, I think a lot of that I would classify as bad journalism, which is a completely different problem. But certainly there are people, and you know, I will talk about this in my lecture, there are people who will simply plagiarize an article, take out the things that are critical to their point of view, put another headline on it, and republish it on their own website.
We've seen a lot of that, a lot of recanning of the same story, but from very different points of view.
Right, and usually without some of the crucial facts.
Yeah, that ends up twisting what the meaning of it is.
Sure.
So what is the historical context of fake news? You say this dates all the way back to the beginning of printing information on paper.
Well, I look at it in America at least as going back to the colonial times, because at that time most of the newspapers were published by people who happened to own printing presses, and their real income came from printing jobs that they got from the crown or later printing jobs that they got from the U.S. government. And they needed another product to keep their printing press busy, so they created newspapers. And at that time, you paid quite a lot of money to subscribe to a newspaper, and you had to appeal to a fairly wealthy audience or an audience with special interests in order to get those subscribers. And at that time, appealing to a very small audience, you usually sold opinion and commentary, and factual news didn't really come along until the 1830s.
Now, I remember studying the history of journalism. Of course, it's way back in my recollection. This was before fake news, before much of the internet. And I was writing my papers for college at that time on actual word processors and typewriters, where hitting the key makes the number the letters show up. So back then, I remember we were studying in the history of journalism. I would read some of the older articles around colonial times and things that had come out, and I was just shocked at how 100% opinionated things were and just complete fallacies were printed. How do you compare that with today?
Well, I think the product that we think of as factual or quote unquote objective news arose in the 1830s with the Industrial Revolution, when particularly in 1833, when Benjamin Day founded the New York Sun, all of a sudden he had thousands and thousands of copies of the newspaper that he could print every day, and he chose to sell them for a penny. And then he turned around and sold his audience to advertisers. And this was the model that really ran for a good solid 150 years. It dominated journalism from the 1830s until the 1980s. And then we began to see audience fragmentation. It's easiest to see, I suppose, in cable TV, where we went from three networks to hundreds of channels, and it became possible to make a living with a very, very small audience, but you had to appeal to exactly what they were interested in.
Well, that's interesting. So it kind of seems like with the needing to appeal to a larger number of people and to get those advertisements in front of more eyeballs so that you could raise the price of your ad, they had to go more towards facts.
I think so. There were two products, really. There was factual journalism. And that was a fairly safe thing to sell because people were willing to have different opinions but to agree on the same facts. And then the circulation wars that came along in the wake of that led to sensationalism, to the kind of stories that you would find in the New York World and the New York Journal when Pulitzer and Hearst were battling it out for circulation towards the end of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it went through a lot of different changes and iterations. So whoever owned – early on though, around colonial times, whoever owned the printing press kind of owned the facts.
I think so. And sometimes people – it belonged to people who funded it. I mean, before he was ever elected president, Thomas Jefferson gave government printing contracts to a printer by the name of Philip Freneau. And in exchange, he wanted Freneau to start a newspaper in Philadelphia that would attack Alexander Hamilton. And so the newspaper was effectively owned by Thomas Jefferson, although his name was not on it. And I think this kind of funding and this kind of influence of the content was very, very common then. And frankly, it's growing more common now. But the sort of journalistic ethics that you and I grew up with and were taught and practiced they followed the business model that made them possible. They didn't precede it.
It's really interesting. I always kind of, you know, idealistically, I guess, as a doe-eyed journalism student in the late 80s, early 90s, thought that the facts were the predecessor to all of it, the getting things right and disseminating information that was responsible and ethical.
That was my belief too. And then I over my protestations, I was once asked to teach a history of journalism class that I was woefully underprepared to teach. And the terrible thing about it, this was at Brooklyn College back in the day, and the fellow who ordinarily taught this class was Eric Alterman, who's a very, very distinguished historian and a great journalist. And I felt like I was being asked to go to Yankee Stadium and pinch hit for Derek Jeter or something. And I really had to learn. I had to study. And that's what got me started on all this maybe 10 years ago. And we didn't have a fake news problem really 10 years ago. It was even more than that. It's 2004, I think. So yeah. 14 years ago.
So, I mean, going back to who owns the printing press, it kind of falls in line with whoever's literate owning history all the way back before America, back pre-Gutenberg, as early on as religious scholars were the only ones who could really write and record things. Is there any study in whether the earliest written manuscripts were fact-based, or do we kind of assume they are based on our modern inclination to expect or hope for that?
I'm not sure about that, but I do know that the printing press itself was a great democratizer because in the very beginning, you could only read if you were taught to read primarily in the church. And then later, when the printing press was made more and more copies available, the same basic kind of process that happened in the 1830s, except this obviously was a couple hundred years earlier. We had people who could get their own copy of the Bible, you know, which was what the very, very first thing that was printed was. And it, you know, that, as we well know, made the Protestant Reformation possible. It made reading something that everyone could learn to do. And it's I think the same process tends to happen over and over again. If you have a radical change in technology, then you're going to change the audience and you're going to change the business model of any business, in particular journalism.
I've studied a lot different the cultural repercussions of booms in literacy, and that was always an interesting aspect for me. But now the boom is I don't think so much in literacy, but it's more image-driven and image-based and graphs. And have you seen people going away from reading as much? They're listicles instead of, you know, in-depth articles that people are paying attention to. And like we talked about earlier, recanning already existing work.
Yeah, I think there's two things going on that I notice. One is exactly what you're talking about, people who are reading very, very short things and rebel in a certain way against, you know, reading long pieces. And the other thing is that we now have a explosion of long-form pieces because during the magazine era, there were only a certain number of pages in The New Yorker and a certain number of pages in Harper's and a certain number of pages in any of these great magazines. And now there's unlimited space on the internet so people can write very, very long pieces, and quite good pieces are in front of the public that might not have made the cut.
So another democratizer, perhaps.
I believe so, yeah.
If you're just joining the show, I'm joined by Ron Feimster. He's a professor of journalism at Florida Southwestern State College. We're talking about his upcoming lecture, which is called Living in a World of Fake News. It's part of the college's Critical Thinking Lecture Series. And if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, you can give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. You can also reach out on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. So it seems like fake news can sometimes be completely fabricated stories with no basis in fact. But also sometimes news stories can be called out as fake news, even though it does have confirmable facts behind it. Have you found news being mislabeled as fake when in fact it's not?
Well, I think in fact the President of the United States has made quite a well-known practice of doing that. He is, you know, condemning CNN and the New York Times and the Washington Post as purveyors of fake news. And when you really reduce it down to what he's actually saying, it's news that he doesn't agree with or news that is critical of him. So there really are two definitions of fake news that are working definitions right now, the one that I mentioned early in the show and also the president's definition.
Labeling something that doesn't agree with your point of view as fake.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to completely fake news being published on the internet, as we saw leading up to the 2016 election, some of it was being made simply to generate clicks and therefore ad revenue, while some of it was being made to sway public opinion. Was there a group of people in Macedonia who were generating clickbait stories and had fake news about both sides of the political coin?
Yes. And I think they discovered that they could make more money with pro-Trump fake news than they could with pro-Clinton fake news. And I don't think that they had any ideological axe to grind. I think it just turned out that more people were consuming fake news on the very, very far right of the spectrum than on the far left. And the interesting thing to me about those people in Macedonia is that they were teenagers. They were 16, 17, 18 years old and just putting up websites and grabbing whatever they could. And if it got lots of clicks, they would leave it up there. And if it was a dud, they would take it down and they would try something else.
And by getting clicks, they would get revenue.
Sure. They were using the Google ad revenue system and they were getting money from essentially by using Facebook to direct people to a website. And then they would put ads on the site and people would click on the ads in addition to clicking on the stories. And that's where they generated their money.
Is there any way to regulate something like that?
It's a good question. And I think all of the major tech companies are under quite a lot of pressure right now to come up with a way to, in the case of Facebook, to change their algorithms so that there is not as much targeting of, let's say, weak news consumers. And Google is under a certain amount of pressure to change its ad revenue model. But I don't think either of those things are going to happen very fast.
Where do you think the responsibility lies then? Does it rely in the tech world or does it rely in the consumer of the news to be a more responsible critical thinker?
Well, as a person who teaches, I think that my influence is actually on teaching people to be better consumers of news and more critical. In terms of what we can do with these very large companies, I think most of them have adopted the stance that they are tech companies. And in fact, if you look at what they're actually doing, you could say that they might be publishers as well and that they should perhaps accept more responsibility for the content that's on their platforms. And this is going back and forth. There are countries like Germany, for instance, where I lived for a long time, has always had very, very strong hate speech laws because they're afraid of the Nazi Party arising again. And they have instituted laws fairly recently that would make it very difficult for Facebook if certain things appeared on their – on Facebook. Facebook would be considered responsible. And I'm not sure, given the First Amendment framework that we have here, that you would be able to do that. I'm not sure. I don't even know. This is a question for a lawyer, not a question for me.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to hash out all the way through. Because
I think so, yeah.
You've got freedom of speech, but then, you know, if you go and you're a publisher and you publish something that is knowingly false, you're in trouble.
You're in ethical trouble. You and I, as journalists, would be fired for doing that, when we would probably be blackballed and would not be able to work in the responsible media profession ever again. You know, then this – we all know examples of this having happened in the past. However
– there's a legal basis of slander, things like that.
Yeah. And I mean it's – you know, you're protected in this country. Hate speech is widely protected, which comes as a surprise to people who have never really studied the First Amendment. And also we value above all other things the right to criticize the government. So it's possible to say almost anything that you want about, say, the president. So President Obama put up with quite a lot of criticism that was not based in fact and just shrugged it off because I think he asked his lawyers, I'm sure, can I stop these people from doing that? And the answer was no. You can't stop them from doing that.
You could try, but you spend a lot of money and maybe ultimately fail.
And you lose. Yeah. Hmm.
And then draw more attention to it, you know?
I think
so. To the negativity.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, you know, some practical applications. What kind of things do you teach your students about fake nudes? What kind of things what tools do you give them to filter through?
One of the things that I've begun to teach is the ICANN look up website called Whois, and it will – ICANN is the Internet Corporation for Signing Names and Numbers, and it will allow you to go in and look at the history of a website and find out who owns that website and when that website was registered. And oftentimes a fake news website will be very, very young. The example – one of the examples I was talking about before with just plagiarizing an article and taking out the parts that you disagree with. The last time I gave this lecture at FSW, which I've done several times now, the website that I used as an example was 1 month old. And there are various ways to look up the history of
the provenance of a website.
So the provenance of a website will tell you quite a lot about the provenance of the information. And then I ask people to think about who benefits from this information that's being put on the web that may or may not be true. And it's just, you know, fairly standard reporting and detective work kind of thing that any journalist would be familiar with.
So for people listening, what do they need to do? If they are reading an article and they're about to share it on Facebook because, darn it, that's telling me what I think is right and I'm going to share that with all my friends, you know? What do they need to do maybe to vet and make sure that they're not continuing to spread fake news?
I would look and see who else has the story. If that story is also on the Associated Press, if it's also in the Washington Post, if it's in the New York Times, if it's in some of the large regional dailies around the country, if NPR has it up on their website, then I would say the chances are fairly good that some responsible gatekeepers have looked at this story and decided that it's true. If, however, for example, there was a story that made a big splash. It came out on election day and no one saw it until much later. But it was published in on a website called The New Nationalist, and the gist of the story was that Hillary Clinton was running a child trafficking ring out of the back room of a pizzeria
in
Washington, D.C. And this story was largely ignored, except that it was targeted to very, very conservative anti-Clinton people. And a few weeks later, a gentleman got in his truck in North Carolina and drove up to Washington, D.C. and walked into the pizzeria with an assault rifle in order to investigate the child trafficking ring. And this brought that story to the surface. If you had seen that story, you could have looked on AP and the Washington Post and various other places and seen that there was absolutely no corroboration for this story in any mainstream media outlet. And that should give you a big clue that the story is fake.
And maybe you don't need to go
investigate
it yourself.
You don't need to share. Don't retweet that, retweet that one.
Because that could end up in the hands of somebody who's going to take it upon themselves to walk in there and figure out. Does it concern you as a journalist, though, that people that are, you know, pretty well-educated people are still kind of following the rallying cry that well-respected journalistic outlets are actually fake news? I talked with a group of people a couple weeks ago, and one of the people who's a leader said, well, CNN is the biggest purveyor of fake news that you'll ever hear. He said this from a position of authority to his flock, to the people that follow him. Does this concern you?
Yes, concerns me very much. And I think people perhaps don't understand the process that people go through to acquire news and to vet news and what the rules of journalism are, how many sources, what kind of verification do you have to have before you can publish something. And it could be that what we really need to do is to go out and have a giant media literacy campaign to help people understand where their news and information comes from.
Yeah, and kind of revealing the journalistic process when you put together investigations.
Yeah.
We've done that a number of times on our show when we have investigations or we have reporters that have done investigations here locally. We sit down with the journalists and talk about the processes that they go through, because I think that people do kind of find that interesting.
And I think it's enormously valuable, because people can't really tell – many people can't tell the difference between a story that might have taken months to report and write and something else that was essentially a breaking news story. To the unsophisticated consumer, it's just information. And
yeah, one that's not versed in journalism too. I wanted to go back to the history part though. It's interesting because you said during our pre-interview that in the early days of our country, the kinds of news that we consider now to be blatantly fake news, it's exactly what the founders were protecting with the First Amendment. Can you reflect on that for me for a minute?
Sure. I think that what people really wanted was the right to object to the way that they were being governed, and that they weren't saying, what I really want is the right to print the facts. What I really want is the right to object to the Stamp Act. What I really want is the right to object to the interference of the Crown in American affairs. And so they said, you know, Congress shall make no law to abridge the freedom of the press. They said, we don't want anything to get in the way of our criticism of government. And of course, when these same people got into power, they immediately passed passed sedition laws and things like that, because that all of a sudden they were the people in power and the press was criticizing them. But I think that we have to realize that the kind of press that we have now is not really that different from colonial press, and that we are, you know, the law as it was written, the First Amendment as it was passed would protect a lot of the fake news that we're putting out there. People have the right to do this. I just don't think that it's a very good idea to consume it uncritically.
Yeah, there's that. But then there's also the part about free speech that says you can't walk into a crowded theater and scream fire, you know, that kind of an analogy. So when you get to – when you think of that and you think about the reach that the internet can sometimes have, which they didn't have when you happened to have a printing press in your carriage house back in colonial times, is there more danger in the fake news now than there might have been back then?
I think there is, and I think that's largely an unresolved question, and that's the reason why, on the one hand, Congress shall make no law is a simple, very simple sentence. And if you go to any law school and look at the media books on the shelf, there's
all of them.
Libraries and libraries full of media law. And that's because we have these situations where one of our rights has to be balanced against another one. And our right to be informed and our right to print whatever we want may be in conflict in a way that we're going to have to have some new legal precedents. Once again, question for a lawyer, not for me.
A question for a lawyer, yeah. For sure. I mean, I don't know who it was, but I heard someone speculate a while back that maybe we need a public media style version of Facebook or social media in general that is ad-free and user-supported because Facebook and sites like it are always going to try to be, profit comes first in a capitalist society. And trying to ask these people, the masses in a capitalist society to govern themselves when it comes down to making a buck, it's probably not going to happen.
No, it's a fascinating idea. I had not heard about that, but I would imagine that there will be a community of people who would be very, very interested in that. The problem is that certain of these companies are so dominant in the market right now that it would be difficult to imagine how you would get that much market share taken away from Facebook or search engines pop up all the time. And in the end, they don't compete very well with Google.
So your upcoming lecture is part of FSW's Critical Thinking Lecture Series. But that's pretty much what all this comes down to. You have to think, judge information critically as it comes in, no matter what the media is, right?
That's pretty much where I come down. I think that there's four things that determine changes in the media. There's changes in the business model, changes in technology, changes in the editorial content, and changes in the audience. And the thing that we're attempting to change here with fake news, we'd like to make fake news less important, less of it, is the editorial content. And we're not going to be able to change technology. We can't change the business model. The only thing we can really change is ourselves.
And it's the only thing we have control over.
Yeah. Right? So I think, I take it upon myself to essentially go out and proselytize for better critical thinking in our college classrooms, because I think that's the best chance. We get students when they're 18, 19 years old and ask them to develop some new habits about how they consume information. And if we're lucky, that will stay with them.
And ask the important questions.
Sure.
And there's nothing more mortifying than if I share something and somebody does a Snopes on it and says that's not true.
Oh, that's
terrible. It's just mortifying.
It's happened to all of us, right?
Well, that's all the time we have for this part of the show. But I want to thank my guest, Ron Feimster. He's a professor of journalism at Florida Southwestern State College. His lecture entitled Living in a World of Fake News is next Monday, February 19th from 6 to 7 on the main FSW campus. Ron, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Coming up, Frankenfest 2018 is underway at New College in Sarasota. The months-long event features a series of film screenings, talks, and even concerts. We'll meet one of the driving forces behind the celebration of the short novel by Mary Shelley up next. I'm Julie Glenn, and this is Gulf Coast Live.